Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was full pomp and circumstance at the White House yesterday as the president unveiled the fact of secret CIA prisons, announced 14 certifiable terrorist suspects are now at Guantanamo, and put the full weight of his office on Congress to approve detainee trials by military tribunal.
Those charged with crimes will be given access to attorneys who will help them prepare their defense, and they will be presumed innocent. While at Guantanamo, they will have access to the same food, clothing, medical care, and opportunities for worship as other detainees. They will be questioned subject to the new U.S. Army Field Manual, which the Department of Defense is issuing today. And they will continue to be treated with humanity that they denied others.
Trouble is, say military jurists themselves, the president is essentially asking again for what the Supreme Court has just ruled against as offending the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Constitution. It may be good politics, or it may not. It may be good policy, or it may not. But the president is moving boldly to put the war on terror front and center again his way. Up next on Point, weighing justice, effectiveness, and the president's war. Joining me first today from Miami is Carol Williams, Caribbean Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. She reports regularly from Guantanamo, Cuba, and was there just last month. Carol, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
The material impact of the president's speech on what happens at Guantanamo. What is it?
Well, I think he has backed off on two major points of contention in the human rights world, one being the CIA prisons that were operated in the dark, even though he's saying that we need to retain this as an option mm-hmm. in the future. He says that they've been emptied out, and that's something I think that's going to go a long way to addressing some of the concerns the international community has about interrogation of war on terror suspects. And the other is the torture techniques, which they refer to them as an alternative set of methods or procedures, but by specifically banning in the Army Field Manual things like waterboarding, where they were simulating the drowning of people being interrogated, these also represent a definition of what is inappropriate that more closely matches the international community's definitions and the Geneva Convention protection.
Explicitly saying no more hoods, no more nakedness, no more sexual torment,
exactly.
No more waterboarding, and right on down that list.
All things that have been used in the past, according to the FBI memos from Guantanamo and the Abu Ghraib incidents that were exposed a couple of years ago. So this, I think, makes it clear that those sort of techniques are not allowed, and that should make the interrogation operations a little more palatable for those who have been criticizing them for the past 4 years.
The president also announced that these 14 terrorists in particular, alleged terrorist suspects, are now at Guantanamo. Big players, architects here of 9/11, USS Cole's ramming, bombing, and a lot more. Do you expect that will change the tenor of life at Guantanamo, the reputation of Guantanamo? How do you see it, Carol?
Well, I don't think it'll change the reputation. The U.S. government has been claiming from the initiation of the detention operations that everybody there is a bad guy, that they're all the worst of the worst, and people who need to be kept off the battlefield to assure U.S. security.
Of those 450, and yet we've read plenty of stories about how maybe some are and maybe some are not quite that terrible.
Right, and I'm sure there are some terrible people there, and these 14 will probably swell that population a little bit. I suspect they're probably going to be kept separate from the other detainees, and there's a facility at Guantanamo, Camp 5, which is a maximum security prison, essentially, and the cells are all separate, cement walls, steel door. You know, the access to the corridors is controlled from an electronic central command post. They can talk to each other when their like food holes are open and when they're being moved from the cell to the exercise yard, but it's a lot more difficult to communicate, and it essentially constitutes solitary confinement when they're in the Camp 5 cells because they're in solid, isolated facilities, and they aren't allowed to exercise together. They don't do anything communally. Everything takes place in the cell.
Carol, you spent a lot of time at Guantanamo. Of course, Congress has yet to speak on this. The Supreme Court has yet to speak, perhaps, again, if it should go there. But there was talk not long ago, a lot of talk, certainly calls from the UN and others to close Guantanamo. Does this raise the prospect of Guantanamo being open and in operation for many more years to come? How do you see it?
I think it does. I think the president's call for congressional action that would essentially replicate the military tribunals that the Supreme Court deemed unconstitutional shows that the White House is not backing off on the pursuit of these men that they have deemed enemy combatants and threats to U.S. security. I did not hear one word yesterday from the president's speech about efforts to erase Guantanamo or close it in the short run. He made it quite clear that it's going to be around for quite some time if they're going to have trials of at least these 14 and most likely those who had been charged under the previous tribunal system. That's going to take years, and I think it was pretty clear that they are not planning to close or even downsize considerably the Guantanamo detention facility in the near future.
Once more with feeling, says the president, and maybe for a long time. Carol Williams, Caribbean Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Carol, thanks very much for joining us from Miami.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Crystal City, Virginia, is Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift, a member of the Naval JAG legal team selected to represent enemy combatants held at Guantanamo. He's a lawyer for Salim Ahmed Hamdan, a one-time driver for Osama bin Laden. Commander Swift was part of the defense team that argued successfully before the Supreme Court in June against the U.S. government's special tribunals for Guantanamo Bay detainees. Hamdan remains at Guantanamo. Commander Charles Swift, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us from Malibu, California, is Douglas Kamek, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University. We've spoken with him many times over the years. Douglas Kamek, thank you for joining us again today.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Commander Swift, first to you. You've represented Hamdan himself, one of the alleged terrorists, before the court, saying this is not the way to do things. Is the president in any dimension asking for something different from what the Supreme Court has rejected, or is he simply coming back with essentially the same project to Congress and saying, give me approval, even if the court doesn't like it?
Yes. He's going back to Congress asking for essentially the same thing, asking Congress now to approve it and in an alternative. Basically, it's the same commission with a new cover sheet.
Is it likely to end up back before the Supreme Court? And if they said it wasn't within the realm, the bounds of the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Constitution before, is there any, if Congress should pass what the president's asked for, might that change the court's ruling, the congressional stamp of approval?
Well, there's going to be a lot of arguments on that. From our position on the Hamdan team, it guarantees it heads back into court if we simply go past the same legislation again. The complaints that we had about the procedures in commissions that the court also found violated Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions haven't been changed. Mr. Hamdan still won't be able to be at his trial. Mr. Hamdan can still be convicted with evidence he does not get to see. Mr. Hamdan still doesn't get the right to a regular appeal under all of the president's, under the new rules, or the old new rules proposed by the president. And it's important because you mentioned that the detention manual that was put out, or the interrogation manuals and other manuals for detention and treatment of detainees, indicated that Common Article 3 is the absolute fundamental bedrock on which we're going to conduct our operations. The Army and Navy JAGs have said the same thing, that we can do that. And the part of Common Article 3 is regular trials that afford all judicial presses, protections.
Humane treatment and regular trials, yes.
And, you know, the Supreme Court's already made a finding here. Five justices determined that the commissions violated Common Article 3. So in one hand, we're saying we're going to follow Common Article 3, and in the other, we're turning around and saying, not really. We're going to use the exact trial that was found to violate it.
Mm. Let me turn to Malibu and Douglas Kamek. Professor Kamek, do you see the president breaking new ground here, putting these procedures potentially on a new footing if Congress approves, or is he simply thumbing his nose at the courts and defying them to reject his proposal again?
No, Tom, I see it differently than the commander, whose work I greatly respect, but I differ with on this occasion. I think the president has very carefully read the Supreme Court's decision in Hamdan. First of all, the Supreme Court invalidated the military commissions in Hamdan, not on the basis of the Constitution, but as the commander properly points out, because they were not statutorily authorized under the existing Uniform Code of Military Justice. So what the president is doing is very responsibly saying, seeking Congress's approval for the structure that carefully balances the need for national security against our obligation to provide a full and fair trial for those that we are holding in detention.
Do you fear or expect this will end up tangled again before the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court said they favored the Uniform Code of Military Justice system. So the president took that system and said, we will observe it in as many respects as we can. We'll provide for a full and fair trial, privileges against self-incrimination. We'll exclude all statements that were the result of torture. And the proceedings will be generally open, and only in, and here's the heart of it, only in extraordinary circumstances will it be closed. And those extraordinary circumstances have to follow some rather specific, and this is quite new, findings made by the military judge indicating that the material that the proceeding is being closed for has been properly classified, indicating that there is no alternative but to make the closure, that is, no unclassified summary of the statement would suffice, and that the closure is no broader than necessary, and that even in the event of that closure, that there be a specific judicial finding that does not deny the defendant a full and fair trial. Senator McCain has made this a specific aspect of his concern about congressional approval of the new system. And I think if he takes a careful look at that, he'll see how much of it is subject to careful judicial review and management and fair to both sides.
The first quotes that I've seen from Senator John McCain look ambivalent at best at this point, but we'll see what he thinks on contemplation. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, is quoted today saying, I do not think we can afford to again cut legal corners that will result in federal court rejection. Commander Swift, how about it? Douglas Kamek says, look, the president's bending over backwards here to try and offer fair and open trials. So does this get him out of the woods or not?
I don't think so. First off, and I'm not the only one, the judge advocates in their testimony to Congress basically indicated that the accused should be present throughout his trial. That an unclassified summary, if you can't do it, you live without the evidence.
And the point there is, just so our listeners fully understand, is that there will be points in the trial as proposed where the accused doesn't get to hear the evidence at all. The jury does, but the accused and his legal representation does not? Is that correct?
Well, his military attorney may get to be there, but his military attorney doesn't get to discuss it with the accused, and he doesn't get it to discuss it with any civilian co-counsel, necessarily. And, you know, as a defense attorney, and that's basically what I've done for 12 years, I can tell you that that renders your ability to confront the evidence basically meaningless.
But has
because the first person you ask on evidence against the accused is the accused. Did that happen? What happened? and that sort of thing. It's extraordinarily cynical to maintain that somehow his defense attorney, without consulting with the accused, could ever confront the evidence.
Commander Swift, put on a bigger hat here for just a moment. Has the president, whatever you think of this, has he effectively checkmated the courts and congressional critics by putting these 14 terrorists at Guantanamo out of secret now, out of secret prisons, who clearly seem to have very big roles, have had very big roles in terrorist attacks, and kind of defying anybody to keep him from trying these people? Has he checkmated?
Well, my coming back to it is just Mr. Hamdan, I think everyone, even the government eventually agreed, is a very little man in all of this. He was only a driver. He didn't go to any meetings. He, other than drive and sit outside, he didn't have really any contact. And his case was about the fundamental principles in a little man. But, you know, Justice Scalia said in Crawford that in the great state trials, that's the place where you really have to make sure that there are the fundamental rights in these great political trials to make sure not only that they are fair, but that they appear fair. And 5 years afterwards, the moving of these 14 detainees, and you know, the clear idea that the death penalty is now going to be on the table. Mm-hmm. Anyone who thinks otherwise is probably missing the obvious, that we're now going to be in the question of the death penalty. We're going to be in the most high profile of trials. The victims of 9/11 deserve justice now. It absolutely drives on get it right now.
Cut no corners. Do it right, you say.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, we do not want to be back here. I don't think anyone. I know that my client and I don't want to be back here 2 years again.
Let me turn to our listeners, if I may. Mandy's calling from Lancaster, South Carolina. Hi, Mandy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. My issue was that I listened to the excerpt of the speech that you played, and the president said that the prisoners would be treated with the humanity that they denied others, but he said that immediately after saying they were presumed innocent. That just doesn't sound like a presumption of innocence to me. It just seems so insincere that he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth, and after hearing that, I don't have any confidence that they will be treated fairly or in a way that we consider American.
Mandy, let us pick that up. Douglas Kamek, here's the president. He has to deal with two things at once. On the one hand, we assume and hope that he wants proper trials for these men. On the other, we saw 9/11. That was quite an affront to the nation. Mandy says he's presuming guilt simply in the way he describes him from the get-go. Is that fair for a head of state?
Well, I think we all speak in these terms when one thinks of the horrific events of 9/11, but there's two things in play there, Tom. One is to respond against an enemy combatant in a military sense, and the second thing is to bring someone into a court of law and to prove a war crime and to impose a penalty on the basis of that war crime. The president can say both things at once. He can say that those who attacked us outrageously and without provocation on 9/11 were in fact barbaric in their nature and beneath the standards of humankind, and at the same time recognize that if we're going to impose a penalty of any nature against an individual in a court of law, it has to be done with due process, and I think that's the proposal that he's given us.
Let's take a call from Mark in Boxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark, you're on the air.
I'm sorry, this is Lieutenant Commander Swift. I'm going to have to sign off. I was on for half an hour, so.
It's great to have you, Commander. Thank you very much for joining us.
Bye.
Let me get one more call here on this subject from Mark in Boxborough. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you today?
Very well. What do you think, Mark?
Good. Well, I've listened to the administration over the past couple of weeks compare these suspects to the Nazis. And so the question in my mind is, why aren't we simply applying the Nuremberg trials rules to these people? It seems to me we've already plowed this ground, and I might point out that Saddam Hussein is undergoing trial right now. The question has been posed by the president's supporters, do you really want to have these suspects given the same rights as American military personnel? And I guess my question is, do you really want these trials, our trials, to be seen as less fair than the ones the Iraqis are giving to Saddam Hussein?
Mark, thanks for calling. Douglas Kamek, Nuremberg trials as a model, would that please the Supreme Court, fit the Geneva Conventions or not?
Well, I think if Mark has occasion to look at the president's statute, and I commend it to him, or the summaries of it, which are available online, he'll see that, in fact, it does parallel the Nuremberg trials in some important respects. By specifying exactly the kinds of crimes that were tried at Nuremberg as being the kinds of crimes that we would seek, the kinds of charges that we would seek to bring against the individuals who are involved in the planning and financing of 9/11. I think some very significant things happened yesterday that will raise the standing of the United States in international eyes. The release of this field manual that categorically puts off limits to the military any of these degrading forms of interrogation that you spoke of with Carol Williams at the beginning, the ending of the secret prisons or the emptying of them for now, the encouragement of foreign countries to take back, as Commander Smith's, Swift said, the little man, the one who's not the main organizer of the terrorist plots. Those people ought to be repatriated to those to their foreign countries, and that will facilitate the ending or the closing of Guantanamo. And then I think a very responsible proposal for due process and trial that is very much akin to Nuremberg, and that when closely examined, I think Americans can have pride and confidence in, and the military can have confidence in, that they would be treated with fairness if they were given the same process.
Douglas Kamek, what about politically here? Do you think the president outflanked his critics yesterday in the courts, in Congress, and beyond by putting those 14 high-profile alleged terrorists at Guantanamo, wrapping this new measure around them? We've got midterm elections coming up. Will Republican critics, will Democrats be in a position to oppose the president when he's bound these things so tightly together?
Well, I think it was a very sophisticated and helpful political move on the part of the president. I think he was largely motivated by concerns of national security and the stature of the United States, but I also think that it clearly puts the responsibility now in Congress. Congress, this particular Congress, has had a habit of debating important issues at some length and not producing any particular outcome. We know that to be the situation, for example, with immigration reform. We know that to be the situation with regard to the terrorist surveillance program. And the president basically said yesterday, we can't afford, for the purposes of fairness to those that we have in detention, nor for purposes of having clear rules that our own interrogators can abide by, we can't afford to just have this discussed indeterminably. Congress has to act. So I think it was a smart move, Tom, and I think Congress now has to make the best of the session that it has in front of them.
Congress may be in a political box. We'll be waiting to see how they frame their response. Douglas Kamek at Pepperdine University, professor of constitutional law there, thank you very much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Our thanks as well to Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift on the Naval JAG legal team selected to represent enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay, including Salim Ahmed Hamdan. I want to pull the lens back now for a broader view of the war on terror 5 years after 9/11. Here's the president yesterday defining his broad goals.
Like the struggles of the last century, today's war on terror is above all a struggle for freedom and liberty. The adversaries are different, but the stakes in this war are the same. We're fighting for our way of life and our ability to live in freedom. We're fighting for the cause of humanity against those who seek to impose the darkness of tyranny and terror upon the entire world. And we're fighting for a peaceful future for our children and our grandchildren. May God bless you all.
The president yesterday in Washington painting the big picture as he sees it. Ian Lustig is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. He's author of the new book, Trapped in the War on Terror. He joins us from Philadelphia. Ian Lustig, good to have you again. Thank you for being with us.
Good to be here, Tom.
Help us put this big speech yesterday, the president's what's being seen as kind of masterful political move, we'll wait to see on the jurisprudence side, in context here of the big war on terror. What's the moment we've come to 5 years on, as you see it, keying off of that speech yesterday?
I think that we've finally come to the moment when we can see the real enemy is mainly this self-created enemy called the war on terror itself. And what it's driving both Republicans and Democrats, so that as this campaign season is here, and this happened in 2002 and 2004, both parties are driven toward excited statements and carefully crafted hyperbole about how they're going to fight the war on terror most effectively, when in reality, what they're doing is fostering more and more anxiety, more and more worries, more and more funding for projects that themselves create more anxiety. The problem of terrorism is a significant problem, but it's way overshadowed by the damage that the struggle against it is doing to the United States.
But let me understand, though, if we've got a war on our hands here, and you can speak to that, but if we do, I mean, wars come with anxiety and high costs, so what's the problem? I mean, those aren't good. Those aren't nice. But if you've got a war, doesn't it come with that set?
Well, you said the important thing. If we've got a war, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. That's true in a real war, like World War II. But it's also, it's even more true, in a sense, in the kind of what's called asymmetric conflict that we're involved with against Al-Qaeda and its clones.
But FDR said that as he took the country into World War, exactly what some, Newt Gingrich and others, say we're engaged in now.
Right. That's what they say. But what is actually happening is not an arm wrestling match in which we might be afraid we're not strong enough to defeat our enemy by pitting all our resources against theirs. That's what World War II was. Instead, we're in a judo match in which our adversaries, weak and marginal players on the world scene, sought to leverage our power to help them. They hijacked our planes from the best transportation system in the world to knock down our tallest buildings, but that wasn't the main thing they hijacked. What they then did is use our own Madisonian democracy, our democratic system and our free enterprise system, to unleash tremendous competition over who's going to spend more money and do more things to treat Al-Qaeda as equivalent to the Axis powers, and to make it seem as if we're in a life and death struggle with them, as you quoted the president as saying. That is what serves Al-Qaeda's interests. They were puny players in the Middle East and in the Arab world and in the Muslim world, akin to the way the white Aryan nation is in the United States. What they needed is what we have been giving them. We have been giving them the idea that they are, that the world order is now a struggle between them and us, the greatest power in the world.
Professor Lustig, you refer to a famous memo by preeminent American diplomat George Kennan many years ago, early in the Cold War, how he suggested the formula he laid out for how the U.S. should respond to the Soviet threat. You suggest that we look there for a model. Take us back there so we'll understand what you're suggesting.
Yes, well, we're all familiar with the phrase sleeper cell. Anybody who's watched television series or innumerable movies or listened to the accusations and fears articulated by the administration over the years knows about that fear, that the idea that there are groups of fanatical but brilliant Muslim terrorists lurking invisibly in our society and about to strike us. Well, that idea of a sleeper cell originated in the early 1950s as part of the McCarthyist hysteria here, the anti-communist hysteria, that there were communist sleeper cells ready to destroy America. And that was at a time when we faced an enemy, the Soviet Union, that developed a capacity literally to destroy us any minute with their nuclear weapons. We had reason to be afraid, much greater reason to be anxious than now. And it took us a while. It took us about 5 or 6 years of that hysteria before we finally said, wait a minute, this is not the way to deal with this threat. It's a threat that we deal with in a long, steady, prudent confrontation and with an enemy that says that they will bury us, but we will defeat them through without a world war.
George Kennan came along and said, let's not go for the apocalypse button here. And he proposed instead?
Right. George Kennan laid down the policy of containment. in that telegram and in that famous X article that he wrote. And that policy was based, it said, we just keep frustrating the Soviet communists, and eventually we will prevail. We have to guard against overreaction, thinking we have to fight a war to defeat them, and we have to guard against underappreciation of the potential threat. And what he based his memo on is what I wanted to stress, is an in-depth analysis of the mechanics, dynamics, and interests driving Soviet communism. He looked directly at that and taught American decision makers what was the core reality in the Soviet Union, what were their actual motives, and what would therefore lead them to defeat. Mm-hmm. What we have not done in this country is look at the real motives of al-Qaeda, the real things that drove them to 9/11. If we had looked at that, if we actually listen, as the president says we should, to what bin Laden, for example, said in the last videotape he released back in 2004, we would see that their objective is to manipulate our sense of ourselves. It's not to kill Americans. They could kill Americans. It's easy. People kill Americans every day. It's impossible to prevent, whether you're a disgruntled postal worker or you're an angry ex-lover or you're someone. That kind of murder attack happens all the time. We have not seen any shopping malls shot up, no bombs going off in places as Israel has experienced so many times, because that's not the intent of al-Qaeda.
But we saw last month what we were told was a plot to bring down nearly a dozen passenger airliners over the Atlantic. That sounds like killing Americans and others.
That's right. And that's an al-Qaeda clone that's coming out of realities in Europe, which are not realities in the United States. And and the British succeeded in stopping that those activities. But note that the British absolutely reject the idea that they are in a war on terror. They see it as a law enforcement problem, not a war against a community. They see it as a struggle against murderers, and they have been successful in that regard. Our government and its a war on terror here has manufactured hundreds and hundreds of accusations that district attorneys around the country have rejected as unworthy of investigation.
Let me ask you, if we look into all this literature, you can certainly find jihadists pushing for a global showdown. You can find that kind of apocalyptic language that President Bush is picking up on. He quoted bin Laden on a lot of it the other day in his speech yesterday.
That's right. He quoted.
Should we discount that? Is that what you're saying?
No, you shouldn't discount it. You should have to understand how that's playing directly into bin Laden's hands. What he did not quote from bin Laden, for example, and what was never broadcast in America is the end of his long videotape in October of 2004, when he congratulated the administration that bin Laden here, the policy of the White House that demands the opening of war fronts to keep busy their various corporations have helped al-Qaeda to achieve these enormous results. All we have to do, he said, is wave a little flag somewhere in the world with the word al-Qaeda on it, and the United States sends armies all around the world.
And you're saying that effectively, with this specter out there, we feel the need to respond to every threat or imagined threat, and in the process, we bankrupt ourselves and maybe bankrupt our values and laws.
Let me quote from a remarkable lecture that was given by a government official urging scientists, including social scientists, to devote their research time to the war on terror. I was at the lecture, and I asked whether he, as a responsible for this, would say that to what degree this was an objective problem, that the government was really, as with the Manhattan Project, to develop an atom bomb before the Nazis did, just turning over huge resources to science and let them figure out the answer? Or was it a wag the dog? Was it purely political? And he said, I can't answer that question in public. But in private, what he told me and others who were there is that on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being it's purely a problem like the Manhattan Project, and 1 being it's really completely wagged the dog and out of control of the scientists, he said it's between 1 and 1.5. So inside the Beltway, among the professionals, it's well known how out of control this is, how thoroughly politicized are both Democratic and Republican statements about who can fight the war on terror better. The real question is, why should there be a war on a human emotion? There needs to be a well-funded, discreet law enforcement effort and intelligence effort targeted at bad people with plots against the United States. That's what we need to do, not to create more violence against us with an overreaction as we did in Iraq. And we are doing that in general throughout the world with the with our declaration that the entire world either lines up with us in the war on terror or that they are subject to our enmity.
Well, I wonder. We think of Americans ultimately as pragmatists, but the line is pushed hard. Let's listen to the president speaking just today, this morning, in Atlanta, where he describes unprecedented efforts to wage war on terror.
As president, I took an oath to protect this country. And I will continue using every element of national power to pursue our enemies and to prevent attacks on the United States of America. Over the past 5 years, we have waged an unprecedented campaign against terror at home and abroad. And that campaign has succeeded in protecting the homeland.
President Bush, today in Atlanta. Let's listen to our listeners. Sally's calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Sally. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. The war on terror is simply a metaphor, and it's like the war on poverty that President Johnson had. And, of course, what he meant was to find ways to lessen poverty. That's what we have to do, find ways to lessen the causes of terrorism against us.
So are you with the president then? Are you saying it's the right metaphor or not?
No, it's not. It's just a metaphor. It doesn't mean anything. What we have to do is to find ways, as they did with war on poverty, find ways to lessen the feelings of hatred for us. And I think that one of the main reasons, and because many Muslims have said this, and many even Americans, our very strong presence with all our military might there in their area of the world, and of course, killing of about maybe 100,000 Muslims in Iraq, that's not one way to lower the hatred toward us.
Donald Rumsfeld said last week that people with this kind of perspective are appeasing the enemy, in effect. Are you proposing appeasement, Sally?
This is not appeasement. This is just being sensible. How would we feel in our country if a great, huge power there are the Muslims came over and invaded our country, actually, and killed many of our people and had their ships and with arms and their soldiers and their missiles and their bombs all around our country. We wouldn't allow it. We would be so angry if they came in and invaded us and took over our country.
Sally, we've got it. We appreciate your call. Ian Lustig, yes, but the towers did come down. The Pentagon was attacked. I mean, there were real affronts to the United States here. President Bush, you know, he's talking today about an unprecedented campaign. We'll go root and branch after this threat.
Well, Sally, I think you're absolutely right. It is a metaphor, but in politics, metaphors actually matter a huge amount. It's the idea of the metaphor of war in which you can be accused of appeasement if you oppose it, an accusation that couldn't be made if the war metaphor weren't used. It drives every group in the country, as I show in my book, from veterinarians to district attorneys to statisticians to pharmacists to pediatricians to universities, to find ways to portray what they want done, the money they want spent on their projects, as part of the war on terror, because otherwise you're not being a good patriot. If you want to reduce terrorism, the way to do it is the same way you would reduce the likelihood of some water molecules bursting into steam. All the and that is turn down the heat. You can't hunt for which molecule is about to turn into steam as the heat gets higher and then stop it from doing it. We have increased the heat in the Muslim Arab world, instead of decreasing the heat. When we decrease the heat, the job of finding individuals will be much, much easier, because there'll be few of them plotting against us, and the rest of the Muslim Arab world will be willing, as it was right after 9/11, to cooperate with us. Instead, we play into the hands of our enemies by creating a kind of jihad mentality that they have been urging their compatriots and co-believers to accept as the reality. We are talking their language when we talk about war against the Axis powers and so on. We are talking the jihadist language, and we should not be.
There's a big counter view. Gloria is calling from Leslie, Michigan. Hi, Gloria. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, very good program. What good points. I say that they're so smart. My God, They used our aircraft to knock down our financial building. They're using our finances now. We're going to go broke sending money over there, trying to fight this war. And we're fighting it on their territory, which is costing us a fortune. And our political field is destroyed. People have lost faith in our government and our credibility around the world. We're going bankrupt because of these people. They're too smart for us.
So what do you say to Ian Lustig? Do you agree, sort of turn the heat down and focus on the particular threats, police them out instead of, you know, military them out?
Yeah, we're playing a game here. We're playing their game. We got to play a game that we bring out ourselves. We're doing things like in an ancient way. We're running over there and dropping bombs and having those people hate us. It's not working. You know, we got to find a different way. I don't know what that is, but they, like I say, they've really outsmarted us right from the very beginning.
Gloria, we hear you. Ian Lustig, are we really up against intellectual titans here in the terror community who have overmatched the best and brightest of the United States?
Well, the caller is absolutely right. We have been sucker punched big time, as Vice President Cheney would say. And what we have to do, we're not, you know, molecules out there caught up in a tropical depression that's turning itself into a hurricane. We, through forces it can't understand, we can come to understand what's driving this and make decisions as citizens to stop it. Let me give you an example. Mm. When the war on terror started, there was a study done by the government. 160 installations had to be protected, 160 critical infrastructure and key resources. But congressmen saw that a lot of things in their district weren't going to get money because they weren't classified as critical infrastructure or key resources. Within a year, that number went from 160 to 1849. But that wasn't enough. Then more and more groups saw that they had critical resources that needed money to protect. The next year went up to 28,000.
So then suddenly everybody's agenda is a war on terror agenda.
Right.
So is that
exactly.
Pork or is that patriotism? BJ's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, BJ. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Appreciate your program. I listen to it all the time. I wanted to say that I think that Bush is right on. He's looking down the road several years when Iran and Venezuela hook up with China. All the this talk that we hear all the time from people worrying about feelings and all that will be over with. We'll be locked into a war based on oil and our future as a free society. And everybody in the West had better wake up to it and get behind Bush and people like Bush.
But BJ, are we scaring ourselves silly? Are we scaring ourselves broke, Ian Lustig suggests? I mean, do you see another way to effectively defuse this without the big money, big war model?
No, I don't. I think that Bush is right on. He's got a lot of intelligent people that's made studies, think tanks, that know the big war that's coming is Iran, Venezuela, and China. China backing up Iran and Venezuela in an oil war in the future, and we're going to be hanging on for dear life in the next 5-10 years.
BJ, our time is short, but we hear you. Thanks for your call. Ian Lustig, respond and give us your prescription.
Let's assume that BJ is correct, and down the road we've got this enormous apocalyptic battle to fight of a traditional sort. Well, we're doing the worst thing we could to prepare for that. For one thing, by launching a war in Iraq under the cover of a war on terror and claiming that there were weapons of mass destruction there when there weren't, it decredibilized the idea that we were going to face such a threat in Iran and elsewhere. So it makes it more difficult for us to gear up politically and economically and in terms of the credibility of our allies, relations with our allies, to fight that apocalyptic war he thinks is coming. So even if you agree with his prognostication, we still should gain control over the war on terror and stop it rather than let it control us, our agenda, and our national resources.
We've got half a minute. What do we do? Bring the boys home and send out the cops? What are you proposing?
The first thing we need to do is allow people to talk about these ideas. The media itself feeds on the war on terror as if a massive blizzard is about to attack, mm-hmm. about to strike a city, but it never strikes. And the media, as you know, loves to talk about the dangers of the blizzard. The same thing is true of the war on terror. The media has to give more attention to serious discussion of its dynamics, what's causing it, what the real threats are, and how they can actually be coped with.
Ian Lustig, you've got us thinking. In 5 years, others on Agree or Disagree, we'd better be thinking. The book is Trapped in the War on Terror. Professor Lustig, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.